The second case for oral argument this morning is Samuel Milland, an appellant versus the State of South Dakota, appellee. For the appellant, we have Ms. Cynthia Burrow, an attorney from Canton. And for the state, we have Ms. Ellie Bailey, Assistant Attorney General from Pierre. Ms. Burrow, you may proceed and you have 20 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, counsel. On a relatively dark and dreary night in October of 2012, police officer David Jacobs from the Canton Police Department made contact with a car with two individuals in it, Mr. Milland being the driver and Mr. Blevins being the passenger. The reason for the stop was a taillight out, and Officer Jacobs issued a warning ticket to Mr. Milland, but the stop took some period of time as they were checking out a warrant regarding Mr. Blevins. Other officers arrived on scene to assist Officer Jacobs in his particular duties. At various times, Mr. Milland was out of Officer Jacobs' vehicle and back in. He had been invited to sit in the front seat both times that he was in the vehicle. He was not handcuffed, nor in any way restrained. At some point during their conversation, which was generally genial, Mr. Milland assaulted Officer Jacobs in that vehicle. Officer Jacobs described the first blow as being a blow to his head, and that he felt at that point dazed. He did, however, have the ability at a point during this altercation when he felt that Mr. Milland was trying to reach for his throat to avoid that particular maneuver and instead take his hand and place it around Mr. Milland's throat, cutting off his air, forcing him back, and causing at least a brief pause in that altercation. While this was occurring in Officer Jacobs' vehicle, the two backup officers noticed it, ran to the car to assist, and eventually removed Mr. Milland from the car by breaking out the passenger window of the vehicle with an asp. This was done by Deputy E.J. Colshan, and then attempting to pull Mr. Milland first out of the car through the window, eventually getting the door open and dragging Mr. Milland head first onto the sidewalk, where they continued to beat him and kick him, causing at least one blow to the head for Mr. Milland, which resulted in seven staples. Officer Jacobs, at this point, exited his vehicle, went around to the other side, and assisted in the arrest of Jeremy Blevins. From that point on, he was then taken to the hospital, where he was treated or aided by emergency room personnel, who washed the blood from his face, did a quick review of his head and face, told him that he should see an ear, nose, and throat doctor, but that aspirin and an ice pack would be sufficient after Officer Jacobs refused hydrocodone. These injuries, the appellant would contend, are neither serious nor grievous.
Wasn't there also indication in the record that the officer was going to need some plastic surgery for his nose?
That was an opinion offered by the family doctor of Officer Jacobs, who indicated that if he did not notice that Officer Jacobs' nose was crooked, but that if he wished to have it fixed, that that indeed would have to be done by a plastic surgeon. There was no evidence other than Officer Jacobs' testimony that his nose was in fact crooked.
Well, he would be, I mean, who would be a better authority than himself, right? I mean.
And I believe that was the opinion of the doctor. Officer Jacobs saw his family doctor three times. First on October 19th, shortly after the accident, where there was an x-ray that was reviewed. There were no fractures in his face or nasal bones. The doctor, again at that time, provided limited medical care, saying that whatever injuries he had accumulated, aches and pains or whatnot, would in fact work themselves out over time, and that there would be no permanent injury with respect to this particular incident. He saw his family doctor again for a well adult checkup and for a last time in April with some issues due to depression. We would ask the court to focus on Janish, which we cite many times in our brief, as being the lead case regarding this type of injury. The state, however, would ask the court to focus on Bogenreif, which they believe has overruled the court's finding in Janish. Appellant would argue that, in fact, these cases are complementary and that each of these types of cases where the definition of serious bodily injury and extreme indifference to human life are at question. The legislature left out very important terms when writing this particular statute. They left out the terms knowingly, they left out the term recklessly, they left out, I'm sorry, there was one more. Knowingly, recklessly. I apologize, Your Honors, there were three terms. It would seem that the state legislature is asking the court to make this determination on almost a case-by-case basis as to what serious bodily injury is. The victim in Janish suffered injuries that one would find perhaps even more serious than the injuries in the instant case before the court. In Janish, the victim suffered some bruising. Ordinary injuries the court described as would be sustained in a fight or a simple assault. There was no real damage and no concussion. That would be similar
Let me interrupt for a minute, because whether or not the injury was serious, whether it actually became serious, does that matter? Because the statute also prohibits attempts to commit serious bodily injury. And so it seems to me that's the question in this case. Even if it wasn't serious, do the circumstances show that this was an attempt to commit serious bodily injury?
Your Honor, that would require, I think, the court to be inside the head of the defendant who did not testify. One can say that he perhaps wished only to get out of the car. He knew there were other officers on scene that would respond immediately. I don't know that he would have had time or the capability to commit a serious bodily injury within the confined space.
But isn't an attempt an objective standard? I mean, that's in a lot of criminal statutes. We see attempts the result in convictions frequently. So what's novel about this case?
Your Honor, Samuel Myland had a lot of experience as a cage match fighter, which came up briefly, I believe, at trial. I do believe that if he wished to have seriously hurt Officer Jacobs, that he could have done so, and could have done so in the time period allotted.
Wasn't there movements at least, or didn't he have his arm around the neck of the officer?
He attempted, Justice Severson, to place his arm around the neck or throat of the officer, which the officer was able to ward off through his own testimony, and at the same time placed his hand around the neck or throat of the defendant.
But certainly the reaction of the other officers indicated that they thought their fellow officer was in peril to do what they did to disengage the assault.
Yes, Your Honor, I do believe that officers always come to the aid of their brethren. I believe these officers acted very quickly to avert any more damage or to subdue the suspect, which is their job.
The attempt had already been made.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe, however, that the court must also look at the companion part of this statute, meaning extreme indifference to human life. In this particular case, I believe the trial court assumed many things not in evidence with respect to whether or not the defendant had any extreme indifference toward human life. The defendant knew, Your Honors, that other officers were present. I guess in his opinion, when he spoke at the guilty finding, Judge Nealis tried to put into place certain assumptions regarding what the defendant might have been thinking and his consideration about the lack, if you will, of having a bright line rule in the state of South Dakota with respect to what is extreme indifference to human life.
Should there be a bright line rule, and what would it be?
That, I believe, is the problem, Justice Wilbur, is that I don't know that there can be a bright line rule. This may, in fact, be the type of situation which gets reviewed on a case-by-case basis, unless the injuries are so similar to another case that's already been decided that there is no reason. I guess when I hear the term extreme indifference to human life, I think more of a terrorist type of situation or a situation in which there is torture involved. I do not, however, believe in this case that extreme indifference to human life standard was met. And I do believe that under the statute, both prongs need to be met. Under the Model Penal Code, which South Dakota statutes took a lot of their language, extreme indifference specifies a special character of recklessness. The trial court in Myland made the assumption that the appellant's attack was fueled by extreme indifference to human life. Given the amount of methamphetamine in appellant Myland's system, his aggressive behavior toward Officer Jacobs could easily also be explained by having that amount of methamphetamine in his system.
So you're saying that it's a benefit to be high on narcotics because then you don't have an intent to have extreme indifference to human life?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that I'm saying that. Mr. Myland was convicted of possession of controlled substance as well. I would not use that as an excuse, Your Honor, but simply an alternative explanation. I don't believe that this statute would indicate that if someone were extremely high on methamphetamine, that necessarily means they have an extreme indifference to human life. Part of Judge Nealis' opinion focuses on closed head injuries. On page 13 of the appellee's brief, the state makes the assumption that the defendant's objective was to render the victim unconscious. This was not a fact in evidence at trial. In the quote on page 13, which is somewhat out of context, the entire quote, if read in its entirety, Judge Nealis used to describe war injuries received by soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan who had head injuries. Again, not just a bump, but a real blow to their head. I think, Your Honors, that if this case were to be upheld, that in any simple bar fight in which one individual punches another in the head, that the state could charge that individual with aggravated assault.
Well, people get killed in bar fights.
Yes.
Or seriously injured.
Yes, they do. And oftentimes, bar assaults are simply two people slugging each other and managing to hit each other in the head. I think that this would, unfortunately, create a bright line rule that if punched in the head, that one makes the assumption, which may not be correct, that there would be specific closed head injuries. In this case, the state did not bring an expert witness to testify that the victim had any type of injury beyond a bruised nose and some bumps and bruises. I do understand the issue of attempt. However, I don't think that the matter of extreme indifference to human life is met in this particular case.
But this isn't a bar fight the case. This is a case of an assault on a law enforcement officer. And it seems to me that our legislature has taken special care with law enforcement officers, that saying that they're to be protected, and with that, when they come with the authority of the state, they're not to be resisted or assaulted or harmed. So it doesn't seem to me it's a good analogy to use a bar fight, because there we're talking about two individuals who are intoxicated who voluntarily engage in fisticuffs or whatever. Here we're talking about a man who assaulted a law enforcement officer without reason, and if you look at the watch the video, it looks pretty brutal. So are we supposed to use a different standard when we're looking at assault on a law enforcement officer?
Your Honor, the legislature has actually created that special standard in a simple assault on a law enforcement officer, which makes such assault a felony as opposed to a misdemeanor for the average citizen. So the legislature has carved out a special designation for law enforcement already. And in this case, the appellant believes that the higher standard for aggravated assault was not met, but that in fact the standard for a simple assault against law enforcement was met. I believe I will finish.
All right. Any questions from counsel from the bench? If not, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Bailey, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court. Counsel, Samuel Myland launched a violent and sudden attack against Officer David Jacobs. During the attack, the defendant delivered multiple blows to the victim's head. Following a one-day bench trial, defendant was convicted of aggravated assault against a law enforcement officer. The state asks that conviction be affirmed. Officer Jacobs' interaction with the defendant began when the defendant was pulled over because his brake lights were not in proper working order. Officer Jacobs then questioned the driver, defendant, and the passenger of the vehicle. Due to concerns, given the inconsistencies in their stories, Officer Jacobs then called for backup. Two other officers, deputies, then arrived on the scene. The first deputy began to search defendant's vehicle. The second deputy questioned the passenger of the vehicle in that deputy's vehicle. At that time, Officer Jacobs and the defendant were both seated in the front seat of Officer Jacobs' vehicle. What's important here is that while they are seated there, the defendant opens the passenger side door of the vehicle and yells up to the deputy who was searching his vehicle and yells something to the effect of, "Make sure you search it real good, make sure you dig underneath all that too." Then the defendant closes the door and engages Officer Jacobs in casual conversation. Officer Jacobs testified that he looked down at his paperwork for a moment, and that's when defendant launched his attack. Jacobs testified, "The first punch landed right square between the eyes on the nose. I don't know how he came over as fast as he did. I was seeing stars. He continued to beat on my face as fast as he could, as hard as he could, for I don't know how long." Jacobs also testified that the defendant had his feet or his knees on top of the passenger side seat and was reached over and beating on Jacobs' face. To alert the other officers that there was a problem, Officer Jacobs revved the car's engine and honked the horn. One of the deputies who had been searching the defendant's vehicle came back and attempted to open the passenger side door. It was locked. He then yelled back to the other deputy that there was an issue and ran around to the driver's side door. He was able to open the driver's side door but was not able to stop the attack. The second deputy then ran up and had to break the passenger side window in order to pull the defendant out of the vehicle. It then took two deputies to restrain the defendant. After the attack, Jacobs testified, "I was in a complete daze. My whole head hurt. My back and shoulders and neck hurt. I had blood running in my mouth, eyes watering. I wasn't really quite sure where I was." Officer Jacobs was then taken by ambulance to a local emergency room. After receiving care at the emergency room, the defendant also received care on October 19th, a day following, from Dr. Olson. Dr. Olson testified at trial that at that time, Officer Jacobs had bruising, some abrasion on the forehead, stiffness in the neck and shoulders, and swelling in the left nasal passage. What is critical in this case is the standard of review. The issues raised on appeal are sufficiency of the evidence, and this court looks at those issues de novo. However, the evidence is to be considered in the light most favorable to the verdict, which is guilt as to aggravated assault. The question before this court is whether any rational trier of fact could have found the essential elements of aggravated assault and that those were met beyond a reasonable doubt. Appellant has raised two issues, the first having to do with the first part of the aggravated assault statute, which requires any person, which states any person who attempts to cause serious bodily injury to another or causes such injury. There is sufficient evidence, and the trial court found that the injuries in this case constitute serious bodily injury. Jacobs testified 8 months following the attack at trial that he had difficulty breathing out of the left side of his nose, reduced airflow, flashbacks, nightmares, and a crooked nose. And as Justice Conan Camp mentioned, no one is more qualified to make a judgment about if their nose is crooked than the individual themselves. Secondly, the trial court found there was an attempt to inflict serious bodily injury. Attempt has to do with, does any act towards the commission of the crime. And there was clearly an attempt here to inflict serious bodily injury, and several factors support that. The first is just the overall violent nature of the attack, multiple blows to the head. Exhibit 2 that was introduced at trial is the deputy's camera that was right behind where the attack took place. It was his dash cam, so it was a forward view. That shows that the defendant launched his attack so violently that the vehicle is shaking back and forth. I think a second factor that supports that this was an attempt to inflict serious bodily injury is that the facts support that he was trying to catch the officer by surprise. How do you really hurt someone? This is not a simple bar fight. In a simple bar fight, oftentimes it's two people coming together to fight. This was an instance where Officer Jacobs was absolutely blindsided. Another factor that supports attempt to inflict serious bodily injury is Jacob's testimony. He states, he was trying to get his arm behind my head, and it appeared he was trying to get it around my throat. In addition, the defendant had to be ripped out of the car, and it took two deputies to restrain him. Even as the defendant was being ripped out of the car, he continued to kick at the victim in this case. Another factor that supports that this was actually an attempt to inflict serious bodily injury is the length of the attack. Exhibit 2, which I've already mentioned, at 23-16-42 through 23-17-20 shows the length of the attack. The attack lasted well over 30 seconds. In addition, I think what supports the attempt here, and the Miskimmins case discusses this, for an attempt, defendants' actions had to go so far that they would result in the accomplishment of the crime unless frustrated by extraneous circumstances. The state would assert that serious bodily injury was inflicted in this case, but even if this court finds that it was not, attempt is satisfied on that basis. I think Officer Jacob's quick thinking in this case lessened the severity of the situation. He had the wherewithal to call for backup, and as he was being assaulted, he was able to honk his horn and rev the engine to alert the other deputies that there was a problem. Certainly that lessened the severity of the outcome in this case.
Ms. Bailey, just what should we make anything of 2218.1.1 on aggravated assault? He was charged in section 1 of this statute, as I read the record, under extreme indifference. Section 8 deals with attempt to cause death or seriously bodily injury by impeding normal breathing or circulation. Now, in this case, you're claiming there was a choking, which is part of it, but isn't that, would that be part of section 8 that wasn't charged, or can it be considered under section 1?
I believe that the testimony was such that he was trying to get around to my throat, and that supports an attempt to inflict serious bodily injury. It was not an actual choking. It was an attempt to get around to his throat, which I think goes better under subsection 1, which is an attempt to inflict serious bodily injury versus subsection 8 of the aggravated assault statute that you referenced. The second issue that the defendant is appealing goes to the second component of the aggravated assault statute, which is circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life. The appellant has mentioned that the defendant was a cage match fighter. Certainly, that's something that comes into play when you're talking about manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life when you are, in fact, a trained fighter. Other elements or aspects that support circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life relates to the fact that the defendant could have exited the vehicle but instead chose to assault the officer. And the trial court made a specific finding on this. He said, defendant wasn't trying to escape. He was trying to assault the officer. I think he was trying to overpower the officer and perhaps try to get to his weapon and perhaps then to assault the other officers.
But that's just speculation, isn't it? There was no evidence necessary to support the idea that he was trying to go for his gun. Not even the officer said that.
That is what the trial court stated, and the question before this court is whether any rational trier of fact could have found that the essential elements of aggravated assault were met beyond a reasonable doubt. And I think that comes into play when this court is asking that question.
Well, I think that's true, any rational trier of fact, but there's no evidence. There's no evidence from any of the officers that this man was going for the officer's gun. That comes from the court only. That's the court's speculation, isn't it?
You're correct, Justice Konenkamp, that there was not specific testimony on the record that would support that he was reaching over and attacking and going towards his throat, but not that he was actually trying to reach his gun. However, there is evidence on the record that when the defendant is being pulled from the vehicle, that he reaches for one of the deputy's batons. So there was some evidence on the record that he was reaching for one of the officer's weapons. There is ample evidence in this case to support that the defendant's injuries constituted serious bodily injury and that the defendant's actions constituted an attempt to inflict serious bodily injury. There is also sufficient evidence to suggest that the circumstances of the attack were circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life.
Can I ask you about that extreme indifference to the value of human life? Because It's difficult to define that. And if you look at other states, they say, well, it's the kind of conduct that would have justified a murder conviction had the victim not fortuitously lived. In other words, it has to be really very, very serious conduct when you're talking about affecting human life. Do you agree with that definition? Do you find that definition useful, or would you propose something different?
Could you repeat the definition, please?
Well, it's several courts say it's. I'll read a couple of them for you. It's designed to be a more. It's the defendant's state of mind would have justified a murder conviction had his victim not fortuitously lived. Or some courts say, by chance, a murder was not committed. That's the kind of conduct that the courts in other states look to say, this is extreme indifference to the value of human life.
I think there are two cases that this court has discussed extreme indifference to the value of human life, and those two cases would be Fast Horse and Scheer. In Scheer, which was a 1980 case from this court, in fact, found that the circumstances of that case did not constitute extreme indifference to the value of human life. The facts of that case, it was the victim was a wife and the defendant was a husband, and he was trying to assault someone who he had assumed was having an affair with his wife, and so he shoved his wife out of the way, and her injuries resulted in a fractured rib, I believe. Later, that defendant shot a shotgun at a moving vehicle that did not include the victim wife. So this court found in that case that because the defendant's intent towards the wife was really to push her out of the way, that did not constitute extreme indifference to the value of human life in that case, because the firing of the shotgun was not so contemporaneous with the actual injury to that victim. The Fast Horse case, which this court found that the facts did constitute extreme indifference to the value of human life. In that case, the defendant punched, choked, and threatened to shoot and kill the victim. The victim had a 3-hour hospital stay, scratches, and abrasions. And this court found that the circumstances in which those injuries were given, that did constitute extreme indifference to the value of human life. It had to do with the overall context and, you know, what was the intent of the defendant in that case. And I think the facts of this case are more consistent and are consistent with this court's finding in State v. Fast Horse.
But you know, in Fast Horse, there was choking. There was a threat to shoot and kill. And we don't have any of that in this case.
It is true that the defendant in this case did not verbally state his intent. But because the state would assert that because his actions were so clear that he was attempting to inflict serious bodily injury, that the standard is not that the defendant need to articulate what he's trying to do. In this case, the defendant's actions were so clear of what he was trying to do, given the violent nature of the attack, that he's trying to catch the victim off guard, that he hit him with such force that the vehicle shook, that he was trying to get around to his throat, that he had to be ripped out of the car, that he continued to kick, that the attack lasted over 30 seconds, and that the results were better than they would have otherwise been because Officer Jacobs had the quick thinking to call for backup and to alert the other deputies that there was a problem. If there are no additional questions from the court, this state will conclude by asking this court to affirm defendant's conviction in all respects.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Bailey.
Thank you.
Ms. Brohl, you have 10 minutes rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. In listening to the state's and the court's discussion about the extreme indifference to human life, I do believe that there is some relationship between the nature of the injuries and whether or not the actor in this case was intending to commit serious bodily injury on her with extreme indifference to human life. The nature of the injuries in this case were so minor as to one could make the conclusion from that there was no extreme indifference to human life on the part of Samuel Myland. One of the cases in the briefs was State of Oregon versus Boone, which was found at Pacific 2nd, 917. There is a definition there for extreme indifference to human life, which, quote, simply means a state of mind where an individual cares little about the risk of death of a human being. Considering the minor nature of this officer's injuries, I do not believe that the defendant intended or exhibited extreme indifference to human life.
Well, you could always say, though, that there were minor injuries because the other officers pulled at the man away before he finished whatever his intent was, too. I mean, we can't judge it purely by the injuries. I mean, someone could swing an axe at you and miss, and yet and you'd have no injuries at all, but that's certainly an assault that evinces extreme indifference to human life. So I don't know how we base it on injury alone.
Well, Your Honor, with the example that Your Honor has used, which seems to me to be somewhat similar to State v. Shear, which the state also just cited, an individual fired a shotgun at a moving vehicle, and that was not considered extreme indifference to human life. So if someone were to be swinging an axe at me, Your Honor, without knowing any of the other circumstances, I don't know that one could say that is extreme indifference to human life. I do believe this is a very fact-intensive case, which all of the cases that this court has decided in the past with respect to this issue are. I especially find the discussion on whether or not the state charged out Section 8 to be telling in this matter. The state, when looking at the evidence and reviewing it, chose to charge this offense out under two different subsections, neither of which was the section particularly regarding strangulation, which is a new subsection to this particular statute, and which we find often charged out in cases. It was, however, in this case, not charged out, simply leaving subsection 1 and subsection 4 for the court to decide under. In addition, I understand the court's comments, or would agree with the court's comments, that there were many assumptions and perhapses, I think were the words that the court used, made by the trial judge in this case. We don't really see an explanation of why guilt is found, a jury guilty or not guilty, without providing their findings. In this case, the judge opined at some length, particularly with respect to extreme indifference to human life, as to why he found guilt. I do not believe that if the act were simply guilty or not, this particular would have filed this case, failed to show with the sufficiency of the evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that there was an aggravated assault against a law enforcement officer committed in this particular case. And we would respectfully ask the court to overturn that particular part of the total verdict and remand it for further opinion of the trial court.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank